All right, I'll call the meeting to order. If you're here, please check in on the computer. All right, we have a quorum, so let's continue with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, Chair's report. If you are planning to come to the county board picnic, we really need to get you on the list so that we know how much food to have. So talk to Arlene tonight, please, and let her know if you're attending and if you're bringing a spouse or significant other with you and so forth. All right. That's all I had under my report. Next is the administrator's report, Steve O'Malley.
The first item I have is the proclamation that's included in your packet, August 2010, County Aging Month, whereas the County Aging Unit provides information assistance to all county senior residents, and whereas good nutrition is important to the community and is ensured through two dining programs, and whereas home-delivered meals provide an opportunity for a low-cost first intervention to allow residents to remain living independently in their own homes, and whereas quality of life of aging residents is ensured through transportation programs, caregiver support, and organized activities, as well as assistance in filling forms and applying for benefits, and whereas all staff of La Crosse County Aging Department work together to provide a healthy and safe environment in the aging community. Now, therefore, be it resolved, La Crosse County Board does hereby proclaim the month of August as Aging Month and urges all residents to join in recognizing the valuable contribution of persons dedicated to ensuring that the aging residents of La Crosse have the opportunity to live a healthy and productive life.
Moved by Bill Brockmiller, seconded by Sharon Hampson. Discussion? All in favor say aye. Opposed, no. Carried unanimously.
The next item I have, I'm actually going to go over to the podium. Once a year, we have an opportunity to really recognize our financial department staff and to receive something that is one of the highest honors on behalf of local government finance professionals across the nation. For the fourth year in a row, and there's a press release actually included, a news release included in your packet that describes briefly, but if you're really curious, you can go out on the government finance officer's website and see the types of local governments all across the nation that actually receive this, and very, very few, less than 10% of local governments actually are able to meet the standards that are necessary to receive the Certificate for Achievement for Excellence in Financial Reporting. I couldn't be any more proud of our finance department, led by Gary Engvilson as our finance director, but tonight I'd like to actually recognize, because we get to see Gary every month, but the three individuals that I'd like to recognize are the people that do the lion's share of the work that actually put this comprehensive annual financial report that you have before you, that is actually the basis for the award, and the people I'd like to just ask to come forward and just personally recognize them are Sean Hanlon, Jonathan Edwards, and Sharon Davidson. The three of these individuals really do the lion's share of the work that put this document together and make sure that the accuracy of our financial reporting is not just the helpful kind of information that you and I need to make the decisions and recommendations for this county, but that it meets the highest standards nationally and internationally for local government. So if we could just ask the three of them to come up, I'd like to personally provide, along with Gary, a handout of the award that recognizes this is the highest award provided for financial reporting in local government by our peers in the system. So again, thank you and congratulations. This is the fourth year of the award. As you can see, they didn't want to stick around very long. They're almost embarrassed to receive an award, and that's an indication of the kind of detail and attention and professionalism that they give us. So again, thank you very much.
So they don't get any extra money, but they have to come at 6 o'clock to this meeting. That's the thanks they get, Steve? Thanks a lot, folks. Really appreciate all your work. All right, what's next, Steve?
Okay, next we'll just turn it over to Gary, who will introduce our auditors from Clifton Gunderson and talk about the report that's before you.
Come on up. Renee Messing with Clifton Gunderson, and also Deb Welch is with her here too. So it's all yours, Renee.
Thank you. We handed out this evening a printout of the PowerPoint handout. And as you'll recall, looking at your financial statement document, there is a lot of detail in that report. It's well over 100 pages long. So we've really narrowed it down here to just the top financial highlights, but we're certainly happy to answer any questions that you have. There we go. On the second page of the handout, as you flip the page, you'll see just a summary of the components of that financial report that Steve talked about. And I just want to make a couple of comments about the components. The first part is a transmittal letter, and that part of the report is actually written by Steve, and it talks about some background of the county, some profile information, and some of the important things that happened throughout the year. The second part is the auditor's opinion. That's the part that's ours as your auditors. And your audit opinion says that your financial statements are presented fairly in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. So that's what the board hires the auditors to determine, and that's what citizens and bondholders and other interested parties are looking for when they read that audit opinion. That's commonly referred to as a clean opinion. The next part is the management discussion and analysis, and that part is written by your finance team, and it really gives an opportunity for the team to present some narrative financial information over and above what is required in the footnote disclosure, and an opportunity to give some explanation of some of the budgetary comparisons. And that, of course, then is followed by the financial statements and footnotes, supplementary information, and a bunch of statistical information. And as you just heard, you've received the GFOA award for last year's report. Your current year report has been submitted for that award as well. The next page gives you a summary of your governmental funds. And these are the parts of your operation that you see on a month-in and month-out basis. Your general fund had $29.9 million of revenues compared to $30 million of expenditures, or a slight decrease in the fund balance of $439,000. Your fund balance at the end of the year, which totals $25.8 million, has about $13 million that is reserved or designated. Those are funds that have either been set aside for specific purposes by actions of the board or don't represent spendable funds. The undesignated fund balance is about $12 million, and that represents about 41% of your annual expenditures. And just to give you a point of reference for that, your policy requires you to be somewhere between 40 and 50%, so you're within the range that your policy requires. The Health and Human Services Fund is the next column, and you'll see there that revenues and expenditures were both about $30 million, with the fund balance decreasing by $828,000. That fund balance is $6.1 million, and that balance is required to be maintained in that fund and held for human service purposes. The next column is the Debt Service Fund. There you'll see $3.8 million of revenues, which really represents primarily tax revenues of the county, and expenditures being principal and interest of $4.1 million. So as your budget planned, you reduced your fund balance in your debt service fund by paying off certain old debt, doing some refunding of debt, and your fund balance is $1.6 million at the end of the year. The Capital Projects Fund is accounting for the expenditure of funds related to the Law Enforcement Center. You'll see there that you had $19.6 million of revenues. That is primarily the borrowing that you did to finance those costs, and you spent about $17.4 million during the year. The $2.9 million that you have in that fund at the end of December is carried over into 2010 to continue the completion of the facility. The next column is called the non-major governmental funds, and this is a combination of all of the other funds of the county. There are 10 different funds that are accounted for in that fund, and you'll see that revenues Of those 10 funds total $10 million, while expenditures total $11.6 million. Those funds decreased during the year by $1.2 million, and you have about $6 million in those funds at the end of the year. There are really just a couple of components of that that make up the vast majority of that balance. The jail assessment fund is about $1.2 million. The old landfill is about $2.3 million. And the health fund is about $930,000. The other funds, they have relatively small balances. So on the next page, you'll see a column that is called total. And what that column represents is the total of all of those funds that we just looked at. So overall, you have about $94 million of revenues and expenditures in your governmental funds. And in total, you have $42.9 million of fund balance. Now, off to the right-hand side of that page, you'll see a conversion to what we call the government-wide financial statements, or the GASB 34 financial statements. Back in, I think, about 2004, we converted to GASB 34 as required by the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. And these statements then are intended to give you a comparison of the county to how a business would keep its financial statements. So we start off with that fund balance of $42.9 million. To that, we add capital assets, and that represents the land, buildings, and equipment that the county owns at cost minus depreciation. We add certain receivables and the internal service funds of $72 million, and we subtract your long-term obligations. So on that full accrual basis, your net assets are $124 million. The next page is your enterprise funds, and these are the parts of your operation that are really operated in a manner very similar to business and are accounted for in the same way that a business is accounted for. The first two columns are the healthcare centers, the Hillview Healthcare Center and the Lakeview Healthcare Center. You'll see that Hillview's operations are about $14 million on an annual basis. Its net assets increased by about $249,000, and it has net assets at the end of the year of $6 million. Now, when you look at the operations of these types of funds, it's also important to look at what happened with its cash flow. Hillview had positive cash flow of $81,000 for the year, and at the end of the year, it has cash of $3.1 million. So the difference between that net assets number and the cash number really represents your investment in land, buildings, and equipment. The Lakeview Healthcare Center, you'll see there, had $6 million of revenue and $9.7 million of expenses, and ends the year at a zero balance. And that's because all of the assets of Lakeview were transferred into the MVHS fund, and certain funds were transferred into another fund being held to account for future capital asset purchases. In the middle of that page, you'll see the solid waste fund. The solid waste fund had about $9 million of revenues, and these are primarily charges for use of the landfill, and $8 million of expenses. So its net assets increased by about $975,000, and it has net assets at the end of the year of $5.4 million. Now, within the solid waste, you'll see down toward the bottom of that page that it actually decreased its cash balance by $2.8 million. That represents investment in the capital improvements within the solid waste, where you're expending borrowed money within those funds. The solid waste operation has cash balance at the end of the year of $9.4 million. Similar to the governmental funds, there are a number of non-major funds. There are seven of those within the county's operation. And you'll see there that they have revenues nearly $5 million compared to expenses of $3.1 million, with $5.7 million of net assets at the end of the year. The largest component of those non-major funds are the Carroll Apartments and the Household Hazardous Waste Program, and about $1.8 million that's held for future capital improvements for Lakeview. The next set of funds that you have within your financial reporting are the internal service funds. And within these funds, you have the highway department. And the highway department, as you know, is an important part of the county's operations. It has about just shy of $10 million of both revenues and expenses, and it decreased its net assets during the year by about $176,000. Its total net assets are $67.5 million, and I think that in this particular fund, it's really important to note that the capital assets make up the vast majority of those net assets. You'll see the cash balance at the bottom of the page at $3.8 million. So essentially, all of the rest of the difference, or about $64 million, represents your investment in land, buildings, and equipment, as well as the infrastructure, the roads and bridges system within the county. You'll see next that you have three self-insurance funds. You're self-insured for workers' compensation, health insurance, and liability insurance. Those funds respectively have net assets of $804,000, $6.7 million, and $764,000. And those funds are held in those funds for catastrophic losses, as the purpose of those funds require you to use them only for that purpose. So that's a very high-level view of all of the financial information that's in that large document. We've also issued to you a couple of letters, and one of them is the audit communication letter, and it talks about the auditor's responsibility under generally accepted auditing standards. And really what that means is that when we do an audit, we come into your finance department as well as other departments within the county. We look at your systems of internal control. We assess where the high risk areas are within the county's operation, and we test your systems. We don't look at every transaction, although I'm sure some of your department heads feel like we do sometimes. But as you can imagine, there are a lot of transactions that run through the county. So we do a number of random samples, and we test all of the high risk areas of the county, and we confirm a number of balances. Within that letter, we also talk about accounting policies and estimates. And the estimates that are in your financial reporting system are primarily related to OPEB liabilities and the landfill liabilities and some estimates within the Human Services Department. In the area of adjustments, there was one adjustment made to your financial statements this year, and that adjustment was related to a prior period adjustment for the other post-employment benefits plan. In the prior year, when that information was put into your financial statements for the first time, it was based on a draft report from your actuaries. When the final report came in much later, we learned that there had been an error in that draft and they made a correction. So that while there was an adjustment to your books and records, it really was something that was beyond the control of your finance staff. There are also a couple of items that are called past adjustments. Those are areas where we propose an adjustment and the county decides not to record that in the books and records. They're relatively minor items, and they are things that have occurred over the years. The first of them is a transportation pool, where the Department of Transportation requires you to account for certain benefit costs that is out of compliance with generally accepted accounting principles. So it's again, it's a relatively minor amount, but it is an adjustment that we're required to present to you. The other two were related to health stop loss claims as well as human services accounts receivable. We also ask management to provide to us certain representations and take responsibility for the financial statements. That representation letter is attached to our letter that goes out to the executive committee. The other matters that are talked about in that letter are really things that deal with the fact that there were no disagreements with your management during the audit process and no difficulties in performing the audit. We also issue what are called internal control letters and management letters, and we made a number of recommendations to the county and to various departments of the county in those letters. and I'll just touch briefly on them. Related to IT controls, we've made some recommendations for access to the financial software, for documentation of system changes, for redistributing security policies on an annual basis, and for department head review of user listings. And those are things that management has responded to in the letters and things that they are taking a look at and implementing changes for 2010. The next item related to documentation of reviews is really related to that system of internal controls. You have a lot of processes within your system of controls that are performed on a timely basis and performed accurately, but the reviews of that information are not always documented. So that, again, it's a relatively minor improvement that we've recommended for documenting the things that are already in place. The comment related to MVHS is really related to the fact that MVHS was new to your accounting system in 2009, and the transactions were recorded on a basis of a verbal understanding of what the agreement required. We did find that there were certain areas of non-compliance with that agreement, and so we're just recommending here that you take a detailed look at the written agreement and bring the accounting practices into compliance with that agreement. And then finally, we look at compliance with policies, and we did note a couple of areas here for improvement within the county system. Probably the most important one of those is related to documentation and support for journal entries that are made within the system. And the finance staff has put changes into place already in 2010 to implement our recommendations in that regard. So to close my presentation, I just want to make sure that all of you as individuals with oversight of the county's finances understand that your books and records are really maintained in very good order. The fact that we only had the one adjustment really means that the information that you see from the finance department is of high integrity, it's accurate, and it's timely. And we certainly appreciate the cooperation that we received from not only the finance staff, but all of the departments of the county. Our audit is not limited to just working with the finance department. We're in nearly every department of the county as we perform our procedures. And we're just very happy with the cooperation that each department provides to us. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions.
Let me start with a couple that I have. One of the topics on the agenda for later this evening has to do with indirect costs and whether we are doing enough of that and so forth. Is that an area that you look into ever or makes any difference to you?
It is an area that we look at to a certain extent. We look at it in terms of whether you're allocating appropriate costs to your federal and state funded programs. And so we want to make sure that you comply with the indirect cost plan that you have in place relative to those programs, but that's probably the limit of what we look at.
Okay. Then the other question that I have is you noted that by county ordinance we keep our reserve levels at 40% to 50%, and I know you guys do a lot of different counties around the state. Where do we fit in? Is that typical of other counties? Are we high? Are we low?
I would say that you are within the range of where counties are. You're probably on the high side. You're fortunate being there because, you know, it gives you some options as you encounter difficult budget years or encounter things that aren't part of your budget and you have a financial decision to make. So I think your fund balance is in a very strong financial position.
Okay. Other questions? Ralph Geary.
Well, to elaborate a little farther on this indirect cost, you said you don't look into it too much. My question has more to do with generally accepted accounting principles and GASB and all that other stuff. If you bill indirect costs to some departments and don't bill it to some other departments, don't we get a skewed picture? For instance, you're the accountant for the highway department. You come in. We're going to run this program. It doesn't affect the tax levy, so we kind of routinely pass it. But you didn't bill off everything that was billable, like indirect costs, and maybe it actually was a deficit. My point is, would it be better off putting it in the proper department and put a, even though they haven't got the money to pay it, and put a receivable in the service departments or wherever that indirect cost was originated? Would that give us a truer picture of each department or enterprise fund or whatever we're running?
So what an indirect cost plan does is it allocates things like the administrator in the finance department and
right.
the clerk's office to appropriate areas, legal department, all of that stuff. So I think that when you look at how to implement your indirect cost plan, it's important to make sure that you're implementing the indirect costs and allocating those costs to any part of the operation where there might be service fees to customers. I mean, those customers might be the federal government or the state government in the case of your federal and state programs. It might be, in your example of allocating to the highway department, it might be a cost that you then would allocate to other communities where you're billing for those services. It probably, from a cost-benefit standpoint, doesn't make a whole lot of difference to allocate some of that indirect cost, for example, to the sheriff's department or to the jail, because you're not billing out those services. So it really, it's more of a policy decision, I would say, how you implement other than the required implementation for the federal and state grant funds.
That still didn't get to my point. My point is, should we have an accurate financial picture of how every department is doing? The way you're saying it, well, if we can't really bill it back to somebody, we don't care if we put it in this department, but if it's billable to the federal or the state or the customer, then we'll throw it in. But I mean, as a person looking at making a decision about different departments and how they're doing, shouldn't we know the exact costs of each department? I don't care if it shows up as a receivable and they don't have the money for it. Our total net levy at the end will probably be the same anyway.
Your net levy would be the same.
Right.
So, you know, if you allocate all of those costs, the county clerk and the finance department, et cetera, out to land records and zoning and planning, et cetera, is that a more accurate accounting of those departments? Perhaps, but not necessarily. I think it's important that you also have the accounting for those individual indirect areas. So I really do think that it is a matter of policy for how you want to look at the allocation of your costs. I can tell you that fully allocating those costs to every department within the county will substantially add to the workload and does not necessarily give you a better evaluation of cost.
Audrey Cotter, are you done, Ralph, or no?
Does any county do it that way? That
not,
you
not
audit?
That I'm aware of.
Audrey Cotter.
Thank you. In your management letter, you talk about the Human Service Department not journaling and doing regular accounts receivable. That's sort of an abbreviated summary. And the management response is that it's only about 3%, but it's 3% of a pretty significant figure. And, well, obviously a good share of it comes in, but it's still, at what stage would you comment in relation to that response?
Well, one of the things that the county is looking at is implementing a new software system that will allow them to record those receivables on a monthly basis and do reconciliation. The issue that you have right now from the standpoint of the internal operations on a regular basis is that the software you're currently using is very cumbersome. It really doesn't lend itself to reconciling on a monthly basis, and so that's really only been done at an annual basis at the end of the year. So I think at the point where you implement new software within the Human Services Department, you would expect to see that recommendation be implemented.
Thank you.
Ray Ebert.
Thank you. Just to follow up on Supervisor Gehring's thing, if you don't allocate indirect costs, isn't it true you cannot get a true program cost if we look at a program?
If you are looking at a program, yes, that could be true. If you're looking at an internal operation, it probably doesn't make any difference to a decision about how much of the clerk's office is allocated to land records, for example. But if you're looking at a specific program and whether that program makes sense from a cost standpoint to the government, it may make sense to allocate to programs.
Correct. I would assume that a private business would be looking at those program costs. I certainly, when the one I did, we had a central processing we paid to our headquarters and stuff, and that doesn't appear we're doing that. Let me just follow up then. You talked about Health and Human Services. They're required to have a balance of how much?
Their current balance is about $6 million. And the balance that is in there is accumulation of services to fees to clients, as well as federal and state funds, as well as county tax levy dollars that were levied specifically for that purpose. So that fund, the money that's in those human services funds is required to be used for that purpose.
Correct.
No particular level of fund balance is required there. It's just that those funds have to be used for that purpose.
Okay, and just looking at the indirect costs, last year, or 2010 adjusted balance, they were billed $187,000 and change. Their full recovery would have been $1.6 million. So aren't we actually taking indirect costs and using that to build their funds and then segregating, say we can't spend that on anything else? So by not allocating those indirect costs, we're padding the social services budget or their end balance.
I'm not sure how you're coming to that conclusion.
Well, you try that again? Because okay. I didn't follow you either.
They're, according to the sheet that Gary has issued us, last year their adjusted budget for indirect costs was $187,000. The full recovery cost would have been $1,622,960. So in other words, there's $1,004,000 or thereabouts that indirect costs that were not paid to the central government. And that is gone into their balance of the $4.9 million, that's, or actually the $6.1 million that you're saying now can only be used for social services. So I'm saying that in 4 years, if they had been paying their full share, they would have a zero balance and the general fund would have that increase that we could spend as we see, as opposed to having it be directly attributable to only being spent for social services.
Gary, looks like you wanted to jump in first.
I don't know if you can necessarily make that conclusion, because if we were to charge human services the full $1.6 million, I gave Renee my sheet, but they would probably have to cut into their services that they provide for their clients. The fund balance is really, in part, that's necessary cash flow that we need to operate that fund. And again, if we charge human services $1.4 million more, they'd cut services by that.
Well, or couldn't we reallocate that, but then we get a true program cost? In other words, so they're that another, and what this goes to a lot is Hillview says we're not on the bell or not on the levy, and if they paid even a good portion of their indirect costs, they would be on the levy. And I think it's just a truth in advertising thing. We're saying, and Hillview is a better example, we're not on the levy. Well, baloney. If they paid their $347,000 instead of just the $28,000. They would be on the levy. And I think that we're really misleading not only the general public, but also members of the board.
Okay, let me talk about Hillview a little bit, being you brought that up. We charged Hillview in the most recent calendar year. We charged them $28,000. The full recovery would have been $347,000. Now, the reason we charged $28,000 is that's what they're allowed to get reimbursement for federal and state programs. if we charged them $347, they wouldn't be able to allocate that to the federal and state Medicare, Medicaid. They would only be able to get it from, you know, whatever private clients that they have, or again, they'd have to cut services, reduce RNs or something like that.
So, but are we misleading when we say that Hillview does not use levy dollars?
I don't think so.
Well, we'll continue to disagree on that, sir. Thank you.
Can you, I mean, I think Ray makes a point there. Can you further elaborate on that? I mean, you know, we have said all along Hillview doesn't cost us any money. In fact, we, with Carroll Heights thrown in, we make money there. And he's saying if we had fully charged them for everything, really, you know, well, it would be the opposite.
You know, again, just as I said for human services, if we were to charge human services the full $1.6 million, they would most likely have to cut their service level, and that would be true for Hillview too. They would need, in order to balance their budget, they would need to cut expenses. And that's, you know, I just want to say that the history of us in the way that we charge indirect costs is a lot due to how we received guidance from committees in the past. The committee members didn't want to cut into service levels. They wanted to provide service. That's what we're in business for.
Steve?
I think one thing historically that may not be grasped right away is the reason for the indirect cost report wasn't necessarily just a cost allocation. It was to try to recover federal and state revenues, primarily federal revenues, because when counties provided services way before A87 even came out as a directive, counties weren't getting reimbursed for that. So the purpose is primarily to recoup the maximum amount of federal revenues that are available for county-administered programs that are paid for partly by the federal government. So that was the main motivation. It wasn't a full cost allocation. You notice that even the list here doesn't include every department or every cost allocation that's possible, because many departments are 100% levy. So to go through the accounting to charge back, but remember the purpose of the A87, the original cost allocation, was to maximize federal revenues where we had indirect costs in supporting those areas.
Yeah, my only point is that we don't get true program costs unless we allocate them, and let's use Hillview. So now instead of them cutting their services, now we just put $300,000 in levy money towards it, and that solves that problem, correct? And yet it gives us a full program cost, and recognizing that there is actually levy dollars involved there.
Leon Paff.
Yes, thank you. Some of my questions were answered there, but what I was going to ask you was when you're auditing things, then you actually have to treat governmental agencies that are involved with the federal government and state aids and things like that different than you do private business or even like co-ops, correct?
That's right, because the level of testing that we do in a governmental organization because of the federal and state funds is at a much higher level than it would be in a business or a co-op or other kind of organization.
Right, because of all the business or co-ops that I've been with do have Clifton Gunderson, one of them does, they do allocate each portion, even as far as, you know, the CEO's salary is put out to the branches at a percentage of what they made and things like that, but that's really not done here with a government agency, correct? Even the board salaries on each one of those is put out to each one of our branch locations on the amount of money that they've made, and that's what the percentage is of what they pay.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're saying is this agency really doesn't do that.
Right. What you really do is you allocate some indirect costs, as Steve mentioned, for the purpose of maximizing your reimbursement from the federal and state governments. So, again, there's nothing wrong with allocating to all of the county departments if that's what you choose to do as a policy method. It's just that all that really does is shuffle numbers around. It doesn't change the bottom line of how many tax levy dollars you levy. It's just in which department are you levying them for.
John Manninger.
first let me just clarify in my own mind. Let's just use Steve O'Malley here and your salary. Your salary is paid for out of a property tax levy. Now, if we had to do it, assess it to every single department, if you went and took a ride out to Hillview or Lakeview, if you had to go to the landfill, if you had to go there, and then they would give you a portion of your salary, that's an indirect cost. Because you're spending a little time out there at Lakeview or Hillview, either one, and you spend 2% of your time there, then they would have to reimburse you 2% of your salary if we were going to try to go down this road of indirect costs, right? But right now, you work, you probably all of your time is almost all indirect. You're a department head working for the rest of the departments. You don't
that's
really
right.
deal with the general public. So, I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about here. And to try and divide your salary into all these various departments and have them send you a 2 or 3 or 5%, whatever that portion of your workload is, that's really what we're talking about, right?
Right. And the indirect cost report is not a hour-for-hour set of billable hours like we would be if I was, say, an attorney billing hours mm-hmm. or an architect billing hours. It's an estimate of where my time as one of the internal service departments gets spread out over the organization. Some years mm-hmm. it's more, some years it's less, depending upon the needs of that department. And that's what the methodology is using for finance, for IT, for legal. It's not a direct billable like it would be if we were a business mm-hmm. where every hour that I could, I'd be trying to maximize billable hours, right?
Right.
It's a different methodology.
If the Corporation Council has to go out someplace because they got a little personnel matter, and let's say it's Hillview again, you don't bill them for your time. You're just
bill doesn't bill, no.
No. So anyway, but that really wasn't the question I had in my hand up before. I was just curious about you folks. You sound like a wonderful, great organization and all that. How long have we had you as our auditor, and do we put this out for bid? I'm just curious. I don't know.
Yes, we do put it out for RFP periodically. We've had them approximately 20 years.
Okay.
Don Bina.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't think I'd get called that quick. I'm kind of curious. You audit a lot of books in different places and different counties, and I'm not sure what the future brings, but you must have some projections in mind. In this case, as I see it, we overspent the budget according to what we put together in general, health and human services, debt services, and highways. And it wasn't that bad because we didn't overspend by that much, and we do have a little fund at the end. But going into a tough year like next year and the following year, I predict, what do you predict is going to happen with all counties maybe? And, you know, we don't know what the state and the feds are going to do at all, but they're both broke. And they're going to be cutting. In fact, they just got $200 million for the doctors to reimburse them for it. What do you project for the future? It scares the heck out of me by looking at what might happen. And you're into this deeply, and I just wondered what your views would be.
Well, similar to your views, I am very concerned about what's going to happen with federal and state funding. I think that when you look at the stimulus funds that were made available, some of the stimulus funds that were made available to the state of Wisconsin were passed through to local governments like counties and like school districts. And what the state did with those funds is they supplanted funds that they were already committed to pay to you. So for your equalization aid that they were committed to pay X many dollars, they paid you those dollars, but a portion of them was federal money. That federal money is going to go away. So the state's going to have to figure out one of two things. They're either going to have to figure out how to replenish that money that they supplanted, or they're going to cut your equalization aid and put it into your lap to figure out how do you either find ways to raise revenue or find ways to cut cost. And when it gets into your hands, that's really your only option. Is to find ways to raise revenue. You're a little bit limited there because the state has given you a tax levy limit. And so really, I think that it will force governments to look very hard at alternative revenue sources, fee-based services, as well as looking at services and determining whether you can afford to continue to provide all the services that you can that you provide today.
I do have one more question, and that is, out of this highway fund of $9 million, I think it was, does that include the stimulus money we got, part of it?
Yes, part of it.
What was it, $1 million for last year and $1 million next year, or how did you allocate that, Steve?
You're actually mixing a couple of different things. We're talking about the financial statement, which has not yet dealt with the $1.6 million stimulus borrowing that we'll actually issue in October. That has not been a subject of the 2009 financial statement. Okay. That's actually part of the 2010 budget.
Okay.
Back to Ralph Geary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Look at that graph that Geary gave you. Who computes that number for indirect costs? Who gives us that number?
It's a company called Maximus.
Okay, so an accounting organization or firm comes and gives us this number.
Correct.
My point is, I don't want to micromanage and bill somebody's 2% time. You already have the number because this accounting firm gave you the number. And I'm only going off the graph because, as the person from Clifton Gunderson, why would you bill off somebody if they're 100% of the tax levy anyway? I'm only speaking of this number. MPO. You would have $10,138 because it's $8,000 budgeted, but full recovery would be $18,138.
Correct.
That shows as an accounts payable. Someplace else, $10,138 shows an accounts receivable. They're never going to pay it. Human Services is never going to pay it. At the end of the year, once you just do an adjusting entry, wipe them out, but for the whole year, you can look at that budget and know exactly what they spent. It doesn't create any more work. Somebody else already generated this number. If you put those numbers, just the ones that are showing on this graph, in those budgets as a payable and a receivable, then when I look, I know what that program costs. End of the year, you make one adjusting entry or reversal entry or whatever you want to call it. It wipes out. We're right back to where we started, right? Nobody's balance, cash went up, down, nothing happened. But we would know what we spent there or what it cost.
Yeah. Part of the way an indirect cost plan works is that a rate is determined and that rate is applied to a base. And so in most situations, that base is a salary base, so it would be X percent of the salary. So it would be allocated. You'd have to build this into your computer system to do it. And that's where some extra amount of time and effort would come into play. And then if you only reconciled it at the end of the year, you would have some work there. But that's really how it would operate, is it would be a percentage applied to whatever the base is.
Audrey Cotter.
Thank you. I believe it's on our agenda down the road this evening to have this whole process explained to us. And as I understand indirect costs, it's basically a theoretical function that can help in management. But the bottom line is that each of the salaries that serve the whole county, they serve the whole county. And appropriating them out to the various departments, it doesn't generally warrant the time and effort, in my opinion, put into analyzing it and guesstimating best guesstimates as to what each department is utilizing of the time. Because if you were going to carry it the whole way through, you would also have the people record the time that they're spending in those departments and balancing it out, which would be much more work than, in my opinion, would be worthwhile. So it's something, the purpose, as I understand, the way we're handling it is for cost share recovery, and that makes sense. But to spend hours and hours going round in relation to analyzing the time in each of the departments by each of the other departments, I don't see it as being useful time. Thank you.
Other questions anybody have? Well, Renee, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sorry for grilling you a little bit here, but
it's okay.
We do appreciate your insight.
Thank you.
All right, Steve.
The next item is Bob Taun is going to give us a presentation that's actually included in your packet. This was at the request of the board, particularly for newer members. We haven't had a long history or a recent history, really, of a lot of interest arbitration. There are two types of arbitration in labor relations. Just if you understand the concept of arbitration, an independent third party helps you make decisions or help resolve conflict. You've probably heard of grievance arbitration, where an issue of contract arbitration comes between a union and management, and you need an independent party, an arbitrator, to make a decision. In this case, what we're talking about is what's called interest arbitration. It's in regards to contract settlements. And that type of background is helpful for you to understand the context for what we're in when we deal with labor negotiations and deal with hard and difficult decisions dealing with lower ability to raise revenue to be able to provide wages and benefits and those types of things. So I believe the board members that asked for this wanted to make sure that those of you that haven't been on the board as long understand the historical and legal context for binding arbitration. So Bob Taunt's going to walk through the basics of the law and give you an idea of what context we're in.
Well, as Steve just summarized, this is a brief overview. Let's see if we can make this thing work. The binding arbitration law comes from the Municipal Employment Relations Act, or MERA, found at 111.70 of the Wisconsin statutes. That is a statutory provision that we must comply with. 111.77 applies to law enforcement personnel specifically, and so there's a little bit of difference there. This goes back to 1971. If you recall, the long strike by Hortonville teachers resulted in a disastrous school year for Hortonville, and at that point, public employees didn't have the right to organize. And so we have the law arising out of that situation to provide a means for resolving issues quickly and without lengthy court battles. Briefly said, the rights and responsibilities of the MEDARB law are that public employees have the right to organize and bargain collectively. There's a prohibition against strikes by public employees. And both public employers and employees may not interfere with the rights of each other. One unit of government that was created as a part of the MERA law was the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission, and we talk about this frequently when we're involved with arbitrations. This is a state agency created to prevent prohibited practices, to enforce the bargaining agreements, and to settle disputes by either mediation or arbitration. And so that's where we get the name, the MEDARB law, referring to mediation and arbitration. As Steve just mentioned, there's two types of things that we're talking about, grievance arbitration, where a union member will allege a violation of the contract in some fashion. And there's interest arbitration, which is the resolving of the entire union contract if there's a bargaining impasse. Now, either the employer or the union can petition the WERC to mediate a dispute. If it's mediation, the WERC sends a mediator to discuss the issues with both parties, and we found this to be very useful. Sometimes the mediator will shuttle back and forth between the parties, and we have resolved a lot of issues with the use of mediators, both in grievances and in interest arbitration. A lot of times you need that mediator just to talk turkey to the two parties. We've had them come and tell the county's group that there's no way you're going to win this. You might as well settle. And they've also told the union the same thing. So the mediators have been very useful, and I think you'll find that many counties get to the mediation stage where they can't resolve the issue directly between union and county, but when we bring a mediator in, we're very often successful. But if there isn't a voluntary settlement, then the matter can go on to arbitration. In that case, the WERC usually provides a random list of five WERC staff arbitrators. They have a computerized system, I believe, that pulls the names up and prints the lists. The union and the county strike alternately to pick one of the arbitrators, and the fee is $400 from each party. That's really reasonable, even though it used to be around $200, now it's $400. But if you use private arbitrators, the cost is from $800 to several thousands of dollars, and I don't think we can actually get an $800 arbitrator anymore. And that's usually per day. So if the arbitrator is out one day for hearing, takes another day to write the decision, you may be looking at a $2,000 bill or more. So the WERC provides low-cost, rapid mediation arbitration. A hearing date is set, and the hearing is usually informal, but the parties may pay for a court reporter if that's necessary. We present exhibits, witnesses, and arguments at the hearing. The parties then may submit briefs and reply briefs back and forth, and the arbitrator makes a written decision which is binding, according to the law, on the parties. And that's the other good and bad part of the MEDARB law. You're stuck with a decision. It's binding, and in most cases there's no appeal to any other authority. But that's part of the process. There needs to be a resolution of salary and benefit issues fairly quickly, because it otherwise becomes a nightmare for finance, for the people involved. There needs to be resolution of issues, and this is the law to do that. The MEDARB process is shorter than going to court and appealing to the Supreme Court, however, still takes between 9 to 12 months to get through this, which is not really all that speedy. But the benefits of MEDARB are it's more rapid than a court process. The mediators do help the parties reach voluntary settlements. And if you go to arbitration, there is a requirement for a two-year contract. Not three, not one, must be 2 years. And the last part is there's no strikes. So we have undisturbed public service. The downside of MEDARB is that 12 months is a long time to wait for a decision. There's no appeal of bad decisions. We've had a few bad decisions that gave us pause how we were going to implement them. One of the disturbing things is there's no precedent binding on arbitrators. An arbitrator may make a decision earlier in 2010, and later in 2010 may decide a case the opposite way. Same arbitrator. But that's one feature of the system. Arbitrators may make an award to balance their record of wins and losses so they appear to be neutral. So you could be on the wrong side of the coin toss. And some arbitrators show union bias, and other arbitrators show employer bias. So it depends on what your perceptions are of the person, whether you think you got a good arbitrator or a bad arbitrator. Now, we do have a good track of prevailing in interest arbitration cases, basically because we don't put out bad proposals to our staff. Some counties are proposing, take-backs and all sorts of bad things in the proposal and then want to go to arbitration and win. There's nothing there to win with. So we're very careful when we go into arbitration. But even so, the delay in implementation is expensive and damaging. When our wages don't go up for the 12-month period, we may have trouble hiring nursing assistants or other positions because our wages aren't competitive in the area. Payroll has to account for retroactive pay increases, retroactive overtime, and that sort of thing. And generally, everybody's grumpy until the decision is made. So employee morale suffers. I think what we've learned from the MEDARB process is that the county does very well to settle and resolve its issues instead of grinding them out through the MEDARB process or through the arbitration process. By reaching a voluntary settlement, you have a certainty of result. You know what you're getting and what you're not getting. You have better staff morale through the process. There's less cost and wasted time at hearings. Your hearing is going to take a full day. You're going to have witnesses standing by. You're going to have employees coming in, watching or testifying. It's just a long, dragged out process. And when you get all done, then we're going to have to sit down and calculate retro pay, which is a big job for staff. So if we reach a voluntary settlement with our folks, we simply have better outcomes all the way around. Now, the MEDARB law continues to operate unchanged through tough economic times. For counties, there's no qualified economic offer or any other limitation on the counties or on unions in terms of settlements. And an arbitrator can make a bad decision that costs us a lot of money that'll be difficult to afford. So those are challenges that we have to work through. Arbitrators are required to take into account many factors, including legal limitations like levy limits. So they can't ignore those things. They need to take into account comparison of wages and hours and conditions of employment in our community, other internal bargaining settlements, and other comparable counties. So you'll hear us talk a lot about comparability, comparables, what are other comparable counties doing, and so forth. And this is another lesson of MEDARB. The system runs on comparability. We have a record of using these counties as comparables, and that was established through several previous arbitration awards. You can see quite a few of the counties are on the eastern side of the state, which has a little higher economic value than we do. However, these are counties that in the past have been within plus or minus 25% of population. The comparability in terms of size is changing a little bit, but these are the ones that we have used. Note that Monroe is not really comparable in terms of size, but was included to balance out the eastern counties by an arbitrator when we went through the highway arbitration. Of course, we have the contiguous counties around us, and we also look to them to see what they're paying, which is frequently less than La Crosse. So just to wrap it up very briefly, the MEDARB law works, and we do like it because it helps us get voluntary settlements. It does help us to resolve disputes, whether it's grievances or interest arbitration. And it's really good not to be concerned about strikes and how are we going to provide public service if we have no employees. But on the other side, the ARB decisions are not predictable. There's no binding precedent on arbitrators. and the MEDARB law is very arbitrator-based. It depends on whether you got one of those good arbitrators or one of those bad arbitrators, and it's very case fact specific. So that's frequently how the arbitrator changes his mind that, well, in your county you have something different than the other county, and so your decision is different. But that's it in a nutshell. If there are any questions, be happy
questions
to
questions for Bob. Bridget Flood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, having sat on the other side and, and listened to Dan Pfeiffer for many years, we were always talking about precedent of arbitrators, and we were always looking to precedent of arbitrators to figure out what we should do and what we could win. Was that simply trying to predict, and there was really they aren't bound by are you telling me we've never been bound by precedent of arbitrators?
We always point that out, and okay. you always want to put in front of the arbitrator a case that he just decided last month,
yeah.
because then you say, yeah. you know, how can you possibly change yeah. your mind? But time after time after time,
okay.
they do change their mind. There's,
okay. Yeah, I find that really interesting. I didn't know that at all.
It's some indication, you know, your prior decisions ought to be some indication of the way you're going to decide, but it's not a locked-in thing.
Yeah.
They,
okay.
they can change their mind.
Don Meyer.
Voluntary settlements. Has that improved over the last few years from what it used to be?
In terms of getting contracts settled, we have a great record. I was looking this up. We don't actually keep track of how many times we've been to arbitration, but I think we have only gone to arbitration 8 times. With just about every unit, the last one was last year with Hillview. We won that one.
Okay. 8 times in what time period?
25 years.
Okay, that's pretty good. Another question. What are the qualifications of an arbitrator? This is a scary statement where he says he makes decisions to balance his record. It's kind of like a state patrolman or an assessor or whatever. it just sounds awful, really. So what are the qualifications?
Most of the folks at the WERC are attorneys by education, and they have all been through many courses on arbitration, how arbitration works, collective bargaining, consensus bargaining, and so they have a lot of training. But the point is that it's case fact specific. So In this particular case, I go that way. In this particular case, I go this way.
It's like zoning.
Yeah. Hopefully not. Chair Hampson.
Thank you. I had a question about the comparable counties and contiguous counties. Under contiguous counties, you've got Calumet, and I'm not quite sure why, because that's certainly not contiguous. Or is that just
I think it's just a bad copy.
Okay. And then on comparable counties, how often are those reevaluated in terms of being comparable to La Crosse?
Well, we're aware of every time the Blue Book comes out, we look at the population, and so we realize that Wood County is basically, I think they have more trees than people now, but the reason we rely on these is because we have several arbitration decisions where the arbitrator has supported these comparables. And we could reevaluate this, but these seem to have worked for us.
So you don't have a set time where you go back and look like after a census or because economic times will change.
The time to change the counties would be in arbitration to argue to the arbitrator that these are no longer any good. We should be using something else.
Okay, thanks.
Maureen Friedland.
A while back I went to a conference on the new affordable health care law, and it talked about a model that several counties around the state are using to decide the issue of health insurance adjustments, because of course that's going to be one of the, you know, the big sticking points all mm-hmm. the time, where employers and employees are sitting together in a group to try to come up with something that they like, whether it's an adjustment to the health savings account amount or deductibles or something like that. In the idea being that when you have the employers and the employees together and they come to some kind of resolution, it's more likely to go through, and then you can avoid arbitration and you don't get into that kind of situation. What do we have along those lines, or about that?
We have, actually it's Steve's suggestion, a number of years ago we formed a health insurance advisory committee, which is all of our unions together and management staff, and we talk about the health issues. We really have relatively little time to hash out a lot of stuff in bargaining. And one of the worst things you want to be doing is trying to figure out your health insurance plan for the future in a two-hour session at night with people that have worked all day long. So we've tried to stay away from that and deal with those things in a day meeting where we have everybody together. We brought in our insurance consultants and other people to talk about the insurance issues that we are facing. We had one of those meetings earlier this year, and we will have another meeting again later this year when we know what our health insurance picture looks like from our insurance consultants.
So if there is some agreement reached, does it have any kind of sticking value, or is it?
Sure, sure. Okay. We have made a number of agreements outside of the bargaining process. One of those recently was a vacation change, and we went around, talked to each of the units. We bargained with them collectively on the change. We write up the change, and then we say, and the next time the contract's open, we're going to put this in. And we've done that also with insurance changes, too, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Ray Ebert.
Thank you, sir. How many members are on the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission?
Three.
And how are they chosen?
Political appointees.
And for terms of?
Oh, I think they're staggered terms of 2, 4, and 6 years.
Okay. The percentage, a good track record of prevailing in interest arbitration, you said we've had 8 cases. How many did we prevail in?
I believe we have won either 6 or 7 of those.
Okay, and the other one that interests me is the factors considered. I was under the impression that local conditions was not one of the major factors.
Oh, no, it is very much. They've changed the law several times. The factor given greatest weight is any state law or directive lawfully issued by state legislative or administrative officer, body, agency, state regulations. The arbitrator or arbitration panel shall give an accounting of the consideration of this factor. The next factor given greater weight is the economic conditions in the jurisdiction of the municipal employer.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's interesting. I appreciate it.
Don Bina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A number of things. First of all, we are compared to all these counties you talked about all across the state. The one thing that we don't compare to is that the income level of the people in this county is much lower than all the rest of them, really. And granted, the arbitrator does take that in consideration when he was here. Mm-hmm. When we were working with the highway department a few years ago, he did consider that, and we stressed that mm-hmm. to make sure that he did remember that. So when you compare the counties, you know, we fall short in maybe more areas than just one. But the only good thing there is, I think, you know, and there haven't been many strikes in the state since we implemented this program. And
none.
Yes, you're right. And, you know, I was on a committee 30 years ago, and we pushed for this statewide. Anyhow, I was a good Democrat at that time. Well, anyhow, the one good point about this is that you are given a choice of five people, and they can send you unlimited amount of information on each one of those.
Right.
And you better pick the right person, because if you don't, I remember we discussed that thoroughly, if you don't, then the employees may get the benefit of the doubt instead of management. And so that is the good part, because they're giving you a choice of conservative to liberal and vice versa. So.
Well, just one to respond to that. One of the counties that's not included as a comparable is Ozaukee. And Ozaukee has very close to the same population, but their income per capita is double ours. And so we argued that, and the arbitrator said, you're right, that's not a comparable. Yeah, suburb of Milwaukee. So.
Oh, but by the way, I'd like Mr. Brockmiller to give us an update on the average income of our county here at some point in time down the road in the future.
But not tonight.
Not tonight. No, I agree with it.
And Mr. Ebert has to stand in the corner and face the wall the rest of the meeting. Monica Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a couple of quick questions. I want to get back to what Maureen was asking you about consensus bargaining, basically. Mm-hmm. And I know work supplies trainers that go around the state and train people in consensus bargaining. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, are there any counties that use that form of bargaining rather than
there probably are. I'm not really aware of anybody actively using that. We did try that years ago with our AFSCME groups, and we decided mutually after doing it that we liked non-consensus bargaining.
It takes a very long time. Yeah, I just wondered. Yeah.
It works real well until you get to wages, mm-hmm. and then it doesn't work.
Well, it worked for us as, you know, as a teacher bargaining unit, but it did take a very, very long time.
Yes.
So anyway, as a negotiator for teachers, you know, we lived under the QEO since the early 90s,
right.
And we're bound by that 3.8, which often meant that wages actually went down because the benefits package, you know, ate up that 3.8. What has our average increase been over the years? Do you have sort of a ballpark figure? I mean, you know, what kind of increases are we giving at the county level?
I don't have the list here, but in keeping with the cost of living, generally, if we go way back in the ancient history, when the cost of living was extremely high, the wages didn't ever match the cost of living. When the cost of living went into the basement, the wages didn't quite go into the basement. So municipal employees are sort of in the middle band always. But years ago, when the cost of living was around 4 to 5 to 6, we were seeing 4% increases. Then it went down to 3. We went down to 2. Then we went to 2-1 splits, which is a 2.5% cost. So we haven't seen 3% for, you know, a number of years now. So.
Thank you.
And some of that is, you know, well, why should they get any increase at all? We do need to keep pace with our other 72 counties. If we're to not give increases for 5 years, we would be so far behind other counties, our staff would be quitting and going to work in Monroe or some other place. Or the fact is we just wouldn't attract people. And so it's a system that we live within.
Back to Don Meyer.
Yeah, this question is for either you or Bob. Years ago, we used to have an arbitration committee for grievance, and you or the chair would select 5 or 7, I don't remember for sure.
That's been replaced now, Mr. O'Malley takes the place of that committee.
There's seven of
them. He is that step. Yeah, he's so talented he can take the place of all of us.
Okay.
But we replaced that committee with him as that intermediary step before you go off to whatever court or arbitration or whatever.
Okay, so it's being handled that way. Thank you.
Ralph Geary.
Thank you, Bob. I sat through a few of them with you.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I remember what Bob used to say. We have to maintain our position. Do you remember that? The union's got, well, the union's got the list. We've got the list. You know who's the highest pays the sheriff's deputies the most out of these comparable counties. So do they. They know which county pays the least. Let's say, for example, Walworth pays the most. They're never going to go down to the bottom. They can't move their position from 1 to 5 or 4 or something. They're stuck. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, we talk about what we pay versus what somebody else pays. My point has always been where they're at, they're basically stuck at. If Walworth pays their deputies more than anybody else, I don't care how they go into arbitration, they can't move their position. Well, we're going to freeze them or give them a drop because we want to get closer to the middle. It just can't happen. They're stuck there. They maintain their position.
It can happen, but it's not easy to get there.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen through arbitration unless it happened voluntarily. But through the arbitration process, you know, I always remember you say maintain our position.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else have any questions? All right. Bob, thank you very much.
Okay. One other point before Bob leaves, but is on arbitration, one of the pieces we didn't touch on is final package. And one of the things that happens is that one of the things that encourages unions and management to work together is to narrow the number of issues, because not only is it automatically a 2-year contract if you go to arbitration, it's also what the parties haven't agreed to, it's total package, union or management, that the arbitrator awards. They can't pick and choose. We could have something in there that we think is completely out of line that the union really doesn't want to have happen. The risk is that the arbitrator may pick our package and they'll be stuck with something that they really don't agree with, or vice versa. So again, there's an element of binding arbitration that forces the parties to reduce the number of issues. So generally, there's an encouragement for voluntary settlements. There's also an encouragement to take the arbitrariness out of the issues that you can have, or the stinkers that could be there, and having somebody just hold the line that, oh, gee, we got to take that into arbitration. You're always at risk that the other party could put something in there that is really going to be hard for you to live with. So,
John Manninger.
I don't want to stir things up. I was just going to say this is a law that's worked well for quite a long time in the state of Wisconsin, and it has had some equalizing effect across the state in trying to make sure that all public employees get a fair shake. You want our children in Crawford and Vernon and in the city of La Crosse to get the same equal educational opportunities as they do in rich old Ozaukee County, and this law has helped that process.
Yes.
Yeah. Anybody else? Okay. Again, Bob, thank you very much. Okay, now we get to talk about the budget.
That's right. As you know, we're working diligently on the budget. We're shooting to bring the administrator's budget to you in September. Don't have a lot of details other than the challenges that I've described are just as difficult as we've talked about. You will see through this monthly cycle the actual non-union resolution that will look at holding the line on compensation for non-union. We don't have any internal settlements for bargaining units for 2011, but you'll actually see that coming in this cycle through executive committee and to the county board. Two of the items that you asked for more detailed information about are included in your packet. We've obviously spent a few moments on indirect costs, so I'll let you take a breath with that just for a moment. Also included in your packet is a one-page item that lists the outside agencies or outside entities that we do provide some funding as well as funding source. I should have had the title say 2010 budget outside agencies, because we haven't completed the 2011 recommendation. But these are the outside agencies that are not directly county departments that we provide some level of funding to, as well as the actual funding source, because some of them are very easy to find within the budget, but you had asked for that. We haven't given specific direction to outside agencies at this point. We've got all of these requests that are in there. Over the years, we've narrowed down the number of outside entities that we do provide funding to. At times, we bring you recommendations that you've either changed or adjusted or reinserted into the budget. So I don't know if there are specific questions about this, but I know very early on board members had asked for a more detailed list to be able to give us direction. Again, it's not too late to have input. Of course, you can always change whatever we bring you as the administrator's budget, but I think this is what you were looking for. And
yeah,
I'll just see if there are questions.
Questions or certainly also comments. Steve said it's not too early to or too late to be making comments. Ralph Geary.
Well, I'm sure I brought this up a few times. I still think there should be some kind of criteria on how we award money. Some of this is more philanthropic or whatever the proper term would be. But, I mean, I remember on the stadium issue, we give $25,000 to the stadium, and one of the selling points was the economic impact, and we give $3,000 to an airport. And I can tell you the airport has more economic impact than that stadium. But you know what I mean? I mean, we could debate that. Some of them are just, you know, service the community, philanthropic, but there should be some kind of criteria because we jostle with this every year, you know.
Well, simply put, the criteria is the direction of the county board. We've tried to, over a period of time, exclude as many outside agencies from the budget as possible, but you've given us direction quite often of what your priorities are within in the budget process. Use some examples. In human services, we used to have quite a few more agencies that we funded. These are decisions that the county board and Health and Human Services Board has given us direction on. Memberships in entities like DMI, ITBEC, LADCO, Mississippi River Parkway Commission. What I'm trying to indicate is this is your direction. This is probably one of the shortest lists you've ever had historically, and that in general we are running out of ability to fund outside agencies, so the criteria has been your direction as a board through your policymaking process of which agencies still stay in there. You may as an individual supervisor agree or not agree with the priority of these, but it's been your direction that has adjusted or moved these numbers that are within your budget, because several times we've tried to take some of these out and they've either been reinstated by motion or sometimes over and above the objection of a governing committee, for example, where we've tried to change that. So again, it's your decision as elected policymakers of what stays in the budget. And that priority, just Supervisor Geary, the example of the stadium contribution. I don't recall if staff even had a recommendation. I thought we brought you the information and you made the decision and the pledge, as I remember. I'd have to look back. But in each one of these cases, it's been the direction of you as elected policymakers, the majority of you, I should point out.
Well, I thought it was like this. I thought you presented the budget and we amended it in November.
I make a recommendation based on what your historical funding of outside agencies is, and we've tried to bring you decisions to reduce the number of outside agencies funding. Sometimes you've just reinstated those, so we don't pick and choose that battle every year, quite frankly. When you've reinstated it a couple times, we don't then take it out and have you put it back in. That's just...
Brad Conkle.
I was just wondering if you could... not necessarily this evening, but if you could describe which of these agencies or organizations have requested funds from La Crosse County and how much they've requested, what their budget situation may or may not be.
To the best of my knowledge, every single one of these has requested the same amount for 2011 that is listed here.
Okay. And then also if I know Health and Human Services had done some work with some of these, and if they could describe their thoughts on some of the funding situations or be prepared to later, that would be great as well.
Yeah, I know that'll be discussed in Health and Human Services in particular, Economic Development Fund, each of them. Is there a particular one that you want us to address? I know we've had a couple addressed at the budget public hearing.
they could be addressed later, and I could talk to some of the Health and Human Services members as well.
Bill Feehan.
I thank the chair. Mr. O'Malley, in previous sessions, you had mentioned that there's going to be a step up in debt service for the law enforcement center. And if memory serves me, I believe that alone would amount to about a 2.7% increase in the tax levy based on equal assessment of property values this year. I'm curious, do we have an idea? One of the other areas that was mentioned was step costs or step up costs in the cost of our labor agreement. Do we have a general idea of how much we're looking at in terms of increasing the tax levy? That would be helpful, I believe, to the board members in perhaps thinking about, you know, which of these items we might trim or eliminate. My own personal goal would be to see no increase in the tax levy. I think that would be responsible in the current economic climate. At least that would be the goal I would have. So I'm just curious, can you give us an idea of what the dollar figure would be or a percentage of increase?
Certainly. The debt service I treat separate because that's actually something that's built in and we've already made the commitment when you've sold bonds and the levy increase that's required to make those payments. Unless you have other program areas you want to cut to be able to make a debt service payment, I would not be recommending that at all. So at minimum, we'll be bringing you a budget that requires a 2.7% increase just to make debt payments. The impact of step increases, WRS, our estimates on health insurance, as well as the residual impact of the 2-1 split that ends up coming over to the next year, is probably quite similar. And our direction to departments in preparation of the operating levy is to bring in a zero. So our goal is to bring you choices that would allow that the only impact would to property taxes next year would be the scheduled debt payment. As you'll notice, when the executive committee considers the resolution on non-union, we're expecting to go to our employees and ask, without bargaining here before the public and everyone, is that we're looking to hold the line on compensation and those issues and to try to hold the operating levy as close to zero as we can and to give you those choices.
Thank you.
For clarification, what he was referring to is on the agenda at executive this Wednesday, which would be a zero increase for non-bargaining employees for the county. Any other hands? Sharon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment about winding rivers. That is part of the rest of the budget, or is that part of a separate?
Winding rivers is part of the library levy.
Right.
So it's separate from the operating levy. We should have clarified that, but
okay.
It is an outside agency, unlike the county library system, which, just as a reminder, is only taxed to the people outside
right.
the city of La Crosse. And Winding Rivers Library we include in that item.
Okay, and then also the stadium, which you know I'm not a big fan of. When can we know how much sales tax was brought in by the state track meet this year?
I don't know that there'd be an exact number. It would be an estimate, just as you dealt with an estimate promoted by the advocates of the stadium at the time. So there'd be no way of guaranteeing what that, but
no,
we can ask the CVB to give us an estimate.
I would like that.
Sure.
Thanks.
Ray Ebert.
Thank you, sir. Yes, one of my favorites is the La Crosse Area Historical Society. And that appears to go only, we have four societies in the county, and I believe that only goes to La Crosse, the one located in the city of La Crosse, is that correct?
Right, the La Crosse County Historical Society is located in the city of La Crosse.
Correct, and as I certainly think if we're going to do that, we should spread that out among the four. If I remember correct, Gary said that that really amounts to a contribution that... it's not that they do a whole lot more than any of the other historical sites. I believe now, doesn't the main library do a lot of that? And UWL, I think, does a lot of that. historical.
We can
archive.
Certainly have representatives come and present to you. We've, as you know, you've made that motion, I think, at least three years in a row. So we've gone with what the majority of the board has asked us to do, which is to put it there. You can make whatever recommendation or vote. We can also bring in reports from either the Historical Society or others if the board would like that. We can arrange that.
Yeah, I just think it's, well, one of the things is I always bring in that night before people get a chance, and since there's quite a few that there's Bangor, Holman, Onalaska, West Salem. So there is a few folks that they just need to, we should be able to do share some of that. The other question.
Wait, can I stop you for just a second there, Ray? I would say any agency on this list that is looking for money from the county should consider coming to our budget public hearing in November. And secondly, those entities you're referring to that are not presently getting money could also find themselves well served by showing up at that meeting and say, hey, what about us? So, I mean, I guess I would put that ball in your court if they want to contact them.
That's, I think, a good suggestion. The other one is La Crosse Area Development Corporation. Can you tell me what their executive director makes? Do we have that figure? Can you get that for us, please?
Oh, sure.
Our LADCO representative is Bill.
Yes.
Do you know what he makes?
I don't know.
Can you report back?
Yes.
Okay.
But that one just seems like a fairly substantial contribution, and if he's making a fairly substantial, if he's making the kind of money that our administrator is, then we, you know, I'd just like to know that.
I don't think he is.
Nobody makes that kind of money.
Oh, moving along on the other agenda.
Just another couple on, like, the domestic violence intervention program. Don't we contract to some of this, or these kind? And that's what I don't understand the difference. One, some we contract to, or the, what were some of the other ones? YMC CASA for Kids, YMC Mediation and Restoration Service. I thought we contract to them. So it's not a contract, but it's a contract.
Some of them are contract. Bill could probably comment on a number of those, but when we get in, Salvation Army, for example, is really a direct contract, and it's a specific amount, and they keep providing the service even though it goes beyond what the dollar amount of that contract is.
Yeah, because, I mean, it just seems strange that some of it, I thought, again, was a Health and Human Services contract with them, and yet it seems to show up here also as a contribution, and if someone can explain that at some point, I'd appreciate it.
I think what I hear you're saying is we contract with, say, an adult foster home, and they get money from the county. Why are they not on the list, but we contract with the Boys and Girls Club for the Hamilton School Project, and they are on the list?
And the biggest difference is in the first case, that would be if the client is there, they get paid. If the client is cured or no longer involved in the system, there is no contract with that. Whereas DVIP, for example.
Well, okay, let me change the examples. Yeah. We contract with Family and Children's Center.
Right.
And it's rotating clients. It's not one client.
They're
specific.
Tied to specific clients as opposed to a number of these that are a budgeted amount that's to provide a general service that you don't know how many clients are going to be, but there are just so much volume, and we can't provide a payment for each and every client. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but sometimes it's not specific to a client. Like, I think, do they still have the leadership program at Family and Children's Center? No, Dean's shaking his head no.
Dean Rupert can help me out here.
When we funded them, it wasn't like we're saying these kids. We're saying here's a program.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, it's a question we can talk a little bit more about. I think I see your point. God, that's twice tonight I said I see your point, and this is not good. Maybe I need to stand in the corner.
Is there a full moon? Or is there
must be. Bill, did you have a...
Well, I believe that most of the human services contracts are based on units of service. There is a specific service, a dollar amount for that service. Human services a number of years ago got away from guaranteeing an outside provider a set amount. So it depends on the usage, how many service units they're providing.
So a quid pro quo, basically.
We only pay for what we get.
Yeah, we're buying units of service. Okay.
Thank you.
That's helpful. Bev Mock.
Oh,
I just wanted to clear up what Ray said. I don't know, you sounded like you thought the library, the main library, had a kind of a historical society element to it. That is the La Crosse County Historical Society. The Swarthout Museum is housed there, and that's sort of the headquarters of the Historical Society. And then, of course, the place down by the river, the other museum, the Riverside Museum, that's part of their why they need funding, because they are housing some museums, and so that's why they keep coming to ask for funding, okay. Plus other things that they do.
Don Meyer. Do you have your hand up, Don? Oh, okay. Jill Billings.
I can shed a little light to some of the history with some of these funds with the human services. In the years that I've been on the board, in flush times, we wanted to give some of these good, worthwhile organizations in the county a little help in the good work that they do and did. As times got tighter for us, we had to kind of tighten up on some of these organizations too, and unfortunately, we had to drop some of the organizations from funding so we could really focus on the basic services that we provide in the Human Services Department. But often the committee, and even more often the entire board, was reluctant to pull funding from some of these organizations. So when the vote came back, yes, we want to still fund these. What the Human Services Department tried to do is tie it more directly into the necessary services that we have to perform. And for a lot of these organizations, you know, Boys and Girls Club, I think they've done a better job as years have gone by to focus on outcomes that we're interested in. And organizations like DVIP can take some of the funding that we give them and turn it into, you know, bringing money, a lot more money into the community. And then there were some organizations like St. Clair Health Mission where we would give them a little bit, but what they would do was so much beyond that, that it was hard to say, you know, we're contracting for X, Y, or Z, because they would do it the entire year, whether we contract for that or not. And the Salvation Army kind of came under that that situation too, where by mandate we have to house disabled people and children. So we said, well, we'll help you with your mission because you can do it more cheaply, a lot more cheaply and cost effectively than we could, and we don't want to set up a structure like that. We don't want to go down that road. You're doing a good job with it. So we give them a certain amount of money, and it lasts for months out of the year. They don't take care of a mandate for the entire year. So that's some of the history as I've been on that board.
Other questions or comments? Jeff Schrader.
With the Mississippi Regional Planning Commission, how many other entities other than the county contribute to that?
I believe it's a total of 8 counties. I'm trying to remember who's our supervisor that serves on that. That's Vicki?
We just had a report right from them, I think, last month, and you received this Mississippi River Regional Planning Commission annual.
Vicki, your microphone, please.
Yes, we just Greg was here trying to think if it was last month, and he gave you a report, Mississippi River Regional Planning Commission, and that answers the question that you were talking about. Here it has on page 7 the number of commissioners, and it also indicates the per capita income, Mr. Bina, if you'd like to look for that in it. And it also talks about the work that they do. So you should have this report. If you need one, I'll give you mine, and then I can pick up another.
I was just asking how many other entities contribute.
They all do. They divide it proportionally.
All right, Ralph Geary.
On that one, I don't think we dwell on it. Don't you have to notify them in June if you're pulling out? I think we passed the deadline. I think that number is going to be fixed, isn't it, Gary? Is it some kind of deadline that they have to get like a 6 months notice or something?
That's right. So and their contribution request actually went down this year, but if that was a direction that the board wanted to re-examine the policy of being in that organization, that's never been raised as an issue. But we certainly believe as staff that we get a lot of resource out of their work, but that's one of the reasons they come and report to you on roughly an annual basis.
I just brought it up because I don't think we should dwell on it because we passed the deadline. We couldn't pull out till next June, so that'd be something in the future.
Anybody else? Questions or comments? All right. Then, Steve, is that it for your report?
Right. And then we've got Gary, who we've touched a lot on indirect costs. But
I just want to summarize some of what was in my document. Hopefully you've got a chance to read it. If you didn't, you've probably gathered from the discussion tonight what it's all about. Again, the primary purpose of the indirect cost plan, it's a requirement by the federal and state government that we have a plan in place in order to get reimbursed on certain federal and state grants. We don't get reimbursed on all of them, but we do on some. The purpose of the plan is not a cost accounting report. Again, it's to become eligible to get reimbursement on federal and state grants. We've been doing this plan ever since they started nationally, which was the mid-70s. The indirect cost consultant comes in June of each year, spends 2 or 3 days on site, and then he spends more work back at the office. What he does is he, like, for example, when he came in June of 2010, he took our 2009 financials, and then he allocated the cost based on those financials, and then we use his numbers for the 2011 budget, so there's always a two-year lag. And part of the lag issue is that, believe it or not, even though we don't allocate to every single department, there gets to be a little bit of a memory loss by certain departments. For example, IT, for example, they increased their support of the library two, 3 years ago. And, you know, it's no fault of anybody's, but when the library director or whatever department's director gets their assessment for the following budget year, they're scratching their head wondering, geez, where'd this charge come from? So then we got to go and we got to dig into the documents, we got to meet with them and try to explain the whole thing to them. So frankly, if we did this for all departments, again, I'm not sure it would make a lot of sense to take Linda Stone's department, for example, and charge so much the zoning and so forth and so on. One thing that La Crosse County has always done is we've worked together across departments. In fact, since Steve has been here, it's even better. He set up cross-departmental teams that work together. I have a concern that if we started allocating costs on a cost accounting basis to all departments, department heads might be reluctant, for example, to pick up the phone and call Bill to get guidance because they know they're going to get billed for it. There's a freedom of movement, freedom of communication that goes on in La Crosse County because we're not doing this cost accounting. And I'm afraid that if we got into that, it just get to be a lot of extra work for everybody. Again, what you have in front of you on the sheet that I prepared were the departments that we do charge. Again, the purpose of charging those departments is either to get federal or state reimbursement or to factor into fees for services. Like solid waste, for example, we utilize those indirect costs when we figuring out the rates to charge for the various programs. So I think it would be, I'm not sure it would be real practical to go to the full cost allocation. Again, departments like Hillview, for example, if we tell them to come in with a balanced budget and we assess them the full $300,000, they're most likely going to cut services. So, and I understand what Ralph said. Okay, we go ahead and charge them, but then we back them out. I think that's a lot of busy work.
Any questions or comments? Ralph Geary.
Well, you brought up Hillview. If you did charge them the correct amount, wouldn't you raise the private pay rates?
We would do that, yes. But there again, see, they have to be concerned about competition. So they would obviously have to look at that to see how they're currently charging with their competitors and so forth and so on.
Anybody else? Ray Ebert.
Yes, sir. I'm certainly not an advocate of micromanaging this to, you know, 2 hours from the corporate council stuff. But we have the figures to macro management. And again, my problem is, and we'll use human services, they're, you know, 1.4 million. And that money they're using to put into apparently an enterprise fund that can only be used for human services. And that really doesn't seem right to me that money is general budget money. Certainly we can allocate to them. And I understand you need some for cash flow. But it just doesn't seem to be a particularly, we don't get a good program cost by doing the way we're doing it.
You know, I think as the auditor said, if La Crosse County wants to examine specific programs, I am all for trying to figure out what the total cost is for that specific program. So, you know, I'm not against allocating costs when there's a specific mission in mind or when there's a specific purpose. But, you know, I when I came out of college, I worked for a large corporation that, they sold a product. And one of the main reasons I left that corporation about 4 years later is because the divisions didn't get along with one another. They were always concerned about the bottom line. And when I came to La Crosse County, I was very pleased to see that we worked together.
And I'm not saying we shouldn't work together, and I don't see that that's the outcome of knowing what real program costs are. I think you're making a molehill out of nothing. Or a mountain out of a molehill, whatever. One of these days. But I just, we need to know what a real program costs, and without allocating these in certainly a macro sense, we're not getting that information, and we're also allowing some units to build up enterprise funds, apparently, that now you're saying we can't take. We're going to borrow money to build roads when that money could actually come from general fund had these other units paid their fair share of the general accounting, or government.
Let's use that as an example. The money that we're borrowing to do road projects, we're not actually raising debt service. It's going to be served by the money that's been kept in highway. So unlike the state, who is tapping different funds to take money out of transportation, we're actually using the health of the highway fund to make that debt payment over the next several years. That was part of the plan that we brought you last year. Part of the benefit to having a healthy fund balance within human services is not just if you're in favor of human services or not, it's the volatility of residential placement and crisis placement. If you didn't have that reserve and you had a drastic swing, which we did last year, by the way, if we can go back to the details of the CAFR, we had a drastic swing in the amount of out of residential placement in mental health by over $1 million. But that was able to be absorbed within the fund balance of human services, and on the flip side, family and children had a good year. So the benefit to having that is that we don't have drastic cuts and swings within service levels because there's a healthy fund balance there, which is the same benefit for the general fund. So we believe that this gives you the kinds of tools to reexamine and justify, and we'll be talking to the executive committee this week about that as well. We can always adjust these to some extent, but it's when you make drastic changes in philosophy that you can have unintended results on the level of services. And the health of our system, the health of our financial balance, is that we can take some of those drastic impacts for a county of our size without having major swings. So we think it's built some long-term health and stability into our system.
But wouldn't that money that you're going to allocate, or that the indirect costs would go into the general fund, and you could reallocate it to cover those unexpected things? You still have the same amount of money.
Actually, the difference is that in some counties, remember, for example, I talked about Eau Claire. They've bled down every single fund, and only the general fund is basically less than 10%, and they don't have any reserves for this kind of volatility.
But we're not La Crosse, or not Eau Claire County.
That's right.
I don't see that. So you're going to say that if we take those costs, we're going to end up like Eau Claire County?
No, I'm giving you the far example of that kind of philosophy, and we're doing it judiciously of trying to be in a position that we are managing these funds. We didn't always have that kind of fund balance in a number of these funds for that kind of volatility, and that and we judiciously have made decisions. You remember the decreases in fund balance in a number of those? Those were conscious decisions. If you remember, we give you a detail of where we're actually spending down fund balance for specific purposes. So, for example, the complete change of DRI, the case management and financial management system in human services is being done from fund balance, not because we've got those resources to be able to do that. Instead of not being able to automate and improve the system, we're actually targeting those resources to be more efficient and more effective in human services, and you make those decisions when we bring you the budget. You get a very detail of how we utilize fund balance for specific one-time purposes.
Correct, but it still doesn't change the amount of money available, correct, to spend?
Actually, it does, because if we didn't have those resources, we'd have to come up with another funding mechanism to be able to do those one-time things.
So we lose money somehow in that whole process?
No, we manage the money that we have and can do things that we might not have been able to afford otherwise had we not had the fund balance.
And we couldn't use the general fund balance to do that. Still the same amount of money, sir.
I disagree.
Margaret Wood.
Thank you. Mr. O'Malley actually got to part of the point. I think we talk about, you know, rainy day funds in health and human services. It's more like a tsunami fund. And those people who have joined us in a day in the life and have gone to see the medically fragile people that the county does support can see how, you know, one or two people can use up a good amount of some of those funds, and we never know when those people are going to be part of our community. So it is a very volatile situation, and we have so far been very thankful that we've managed the money the way we have.
Bill Fian.
Thank you. My question goes to the policy that we have that says that we'll hold 40% to 50% back. And it seems to me that the economic times we're in right now, I believe the real rate of unemployment's about 17%, and doesn't seem like we're in the midst of a roaring recovery right now. I believe the auditor said earlier that 40 or 50% reserves is on the high end relative to other counties they've worked with. So wouldn't now be the time to look at changing that policy and using some of our reserves so that we're not raising taxes on people in this economy? Isn't that the purpose of that reserve?
I guess that's a complicated issue, but that's always a policy debate of this body. My recommendation would be that the 2011 budget is not the time to redebate the level of fund balance, but towards 2012. The health of your fund balance right now, both in general fund and otherwise, will allow you to be able to weather some of the impacts, but if you rely on savings for ongoing new spending, it will double up your budget problem in the next year. You need to be able to control within what's coming in as revenues, and that's what I'm going to be bringing to you. That's why I talked earlier. We need to be able to raise the levy enough to make a debt payment and do everything we can to not make our financial problems more difficult in future years by holding the line on everything we possibly can in the operating levy, and then take a deep breath and see what the state and governor do to us in the next budget and make those changes comparable to where the cuts actually happen. You can always, and I would not debate that we should constantly look at what is the right amount of fund balance. I know that some of the history, and the full board should have a discussion of that history. I know some of the longer-term members, Supervisor Geary, Supervisor Doyle, know a period of time where this county spent down virtually every fund balance that they could and found themselves in a very difficult financial position. But certainly, there is no exact science about what the dollar amount of fund balance should be, but it should be done in small incremental changes, and I urge you to have that discussion when we know what the next biennium's budget is and what is that dollar amount, rather than use savings now, which is fund balance, to control a level of spending that will just compound the problem into the next year.
Steve, again, I'm not sure everybody has heard your explanation of why 2012 is likely to be worse than 2011. If you can explain that, because
yeah,
there is a rationale where you're coming from.
I've tried to do that, but let me try to touch on that again. We only know what the level of funding is for existing services based on the existing programs and the existing services, from base county allocation to existing surcharges to the current level of shared revenue. The governor's budget will not be submitted until February of next year. That's 4 months after you will have to adopt the county budget going into next year. We only know what we can count on right now. We can't make cuts unrelated to where the cuts will actually come in any particular categorical aid. We also next year will only know what the governor presents. That doesn't mean what the legislature is actually going to adopt. The governor's office right now, based on the outgoing governor, is preparing for a 10% cut across the board, but not in certain human services, not in corrections, not in K-12. Trying to hit a moving target next year is not going to do us any good, but our goal this year is to do as little harm as possible and to not compound our problem into next year. We know we've already committed to a debt service payment, so let's take on what we've already committed to. After that, let's not harm programs any more than we need to, make small incremental changes, but also not escalate the financial issues that we're going to have to catch up with next year when we know where those changes are. If the governor's budget changes highway aids, for example, we need to make sure that that's where the cut happens. If the cut happens in human services, we have to, as judiciously as possible, try to minimize that impact, but that's where the targeted cut would have to be. We are budgeting almost in the dark right now because we don't know what the governor and the next legislature will do. But let me give you some optimistic news. Just this past week, the U.S. Senate, adopted a change that will end up impacting K-12 education and Medicaid funding. K-12 will help benefit us because it may minimize the impact they do to shared revenue to cities and counties. Medicaid ends up impacting us in both of our nursing homes and human services. I'm not totally optimistic enough to believe that change will end up eliminating any of the impact, but it will minimize some of that. If the Senate hadn't passed that and now the House is coming back into session, the impact next year would have been much worse for us. So we just have to take a deep breath, do as little harm as possible on our existing system, do the best job we can to be as low cost as possible going into next year, and see what the governor's budget and the legislature actually does. But you're exactly right. We can't escalate the problem into next year. We have to minimize the impact on property taxpayers as much as possible, but we do still have to make the debt payment that we committed to across the street for the project. And if you remember, we laddered in that debt. We didn't have just a big impact on everybody. We tried to do that as judiciously as possible. So that's why I'm saying the 2011 budget will be difficult, but it's going to be 2012 and beyond that's going to be much more difficult, because then we'll know what the legislature and the governor have adopted and where specifically they've impacted us.
Well, and you've also talked about how year one of a biennium is different than year two because
they
backload the pain.
Thank you. The point is that generally when they do that, they know that they're only dealing with 6 months of our calendar year budget. So what they tend to do is backload the pain or cuts into our next two calendar years, which are 2012 and 2013. Because when they come in, remember, their fiscal year starts July 1. So February, the governor presents a budget. The legislature argues and fights about it and tries to adopt it by July 1. Sometimes they don't even do that. So, but they tend to not impact cities and counties, and there are contradictions to it, in that first 6 months of their biennium. So we know for the most part, we believe for the most part, 2011 should be pretty close to where we're at. It's subject to change. They can still change that. In fact, the state across the river actually balanced part of their budget in December on cities and counties at the last moment by a governor's action, and that's still being challenged in court and that type of thing. But given our practice in this state, they tend to minimize their impact in the first 6 months of their biennium, the final 6 months of our calendar year, and push that pain, if they cut us, into the next two calendar years, which for us is 2012 and 2013. But we can't make our problem that much worse. That's why I'm asking for a hold-the-line budget in every way we possibly can, asking our employees to work with us as much as possible to control those, but at the same time at least make the payment that we have to and build that into our debt service and then minimize the impact everywhere else. and then you're going to have to make many of the tough policy choices beyond that into the future. So that's what I'm trying to prepare you for.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're counseling that we should not change our reserves at this point because you're anticipating that we're going to have difficult budgets in 2012 and 2013. So your feeling is that the current level of reserves will be needed to work through that period of time. At some point, the economy is going to recover. We're going to see new building increase in our tax base. But what you're saying is you think right now we should hold the current level of reserves for 2012 and 2013.
Yes, because of the volatility of expenses that we are, because nobody ever talks about relieving our responsibility to pay for residential placement for kids, for residential placement for mentally ill. Nobody ever relieves us of the mandate. They just change how much we can raise revenues beyond what the feds and state provide us. And we need to have that to be able to deal with that volatility, as well as the cutbacks in federal and state revenue to pay for the programs they require us to provide.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Other questions, comments? Ralph Geary.
Geary, or somebody explain this to me about Hillview and Lakeview. Hillview pays $28,000 and Lakeview pays $275,000, and I thought we had a presentation about Lakeview losing $1.5 million or some ungodly number.
Prior to the development of MVHS, Lakeview was probably paying a similar amount that Hillview is paying. But again, in order to recoup what we don't get reimbursed by Medicaid at Lakeview, in order to recoup that from clients of other counties, again, it's basically a fee for service.
Right, but aren't we the lion's share of it anyway of that?
If I might interject, we're roughly about 60% of clients, but if we didn't charge that back, we wouldn't get that balance of 40% from the other members of MVHS.
Okay, so 60% of 275, La Crosse County is on the hook for whatever that is, 150,000, 160,000.
Which we were on the hook for anyway because we were paying internal service departments that anyway, but this is a way of shifting it to maximize an outside revenue source. Anytime we can maximize another revenue source, that's why we do it.
Right. Well, okay, I understand how that works. So then we shift some money there to cover our 160 anyway.
We allocate that cost to there because there's a way of getting reimbursement, whether it's a federal program, a state program, a fee or service. If we can get another revenue source, we will, which also is an example.
Right. We're billing the other counties. I got it. Right. I got it there. But our portion, we don't really generate enough money from. We got to transfer some money in or excess sales tax or something to cover our 160.
No, it's actually shown as a revenue in your non-departmental. So you're shifting levy from my department, Gary's bills, to that area.
Yeah.
You don't levy for it twice. It's shown as a revenue in the non-departmental.
Okay.
But it maximizes another revenue source.
Right, we're getting it from the other counties.
Right.
Their
for
portion.
A portion of it. If we didn't have that, we didn't used to do that before MVHS.
We really don't recover 275. We recover 120 or something or 100,000.
Right, but that would require an asterisk, and we'd have to show that, and it depends on the actual census for that particular year, et cetera, et cetera.
Any other questions or comments? All right. I think that gets us to the end of your report, right, Mr. O'Malley?
That's correct. Did we resolve the issue of when the next policy planning meeting is because of the Labor Day?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
But since you mentioned it, just to remind people, next policy planning will be Monday, September 13th. So we've just pushed it back a week. Monday, September 13th. So we're having two meetings that week. Regular county board is the 16th. Policy planning is Monday, the 13th. Again, we're starting to talk about budget stuff at executive committee. In particular, the non-union pay. So I would certainly encourage anybody who has any interest and has the time. Executive Committee meets at 1:30 on Wednesday. You're certainly all invited. We have a notice that just went out this afternoon. We'll be having a closed session on the skipper liner issue. As county board members, if you are interested in attending, you are welcome to stay for the closed session. But that's all I will say. Wednesday at 1:30. Oh, well, next week, you mean? Next Thursday. It depends upon if we have anything that we can talk about at that point. Yeah, we could send out a closed session notice.
I mean, if you're going to do it to the executive committee, I think that some of the other us might be interested as well.
Right. What I'm getting at is it's such a fluid situation that God knows what we'll have to report at that point. But, yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
Thank you.
Sure.
Three times.
Damn. All right. We need to adjourn, all right? This is going on too long. Andrea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on the new ID tags that were people, I had mine done today, but I don't see a code on the back for entry to the doors. Is there nothing?
It works.
It does work?
Yes.
Okay, I just wanted to double check.
Yeah.
Hey, thank
mine
you.
Mine did, I know it works because I did tonight.
Okay, thank you.
Ralph Gary.
Well, I got a point. You know, we got this 2010 directory from the Wisconsin Counties Association. What a great book! But all this information is available on the internet. We're paying dues into this, and I'd like them to spend money on something more significant. This has got to be an expensive book that gives me no information. That if I went to anybody's website, I could find out who's on the county board and who the department heads is, and a paragraph on the county facts. I don't know what this book costs, but I'm thinking every county supervisor in the state of Wisconsin is probably looking at one right now. You know, we could spend it a little better. So, who's ever our representative on there, I'm unhappy about this expenditure.
Oh, that's a good point. Maureen Friedland.
And it does weigh a lot, so maybe the best thing that can be done is to put it into the recycling bin over here to help us out with our 73,000 pounds tonnage for Excel.
There you go. All right, anybody else? Moved by Don Meyer to adjourn, second by Vicki Burke. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed no. Carried unanimously.